Let me see. Okay, this is recording. All right. Hi, this is William Ramsey. Welcome to William Ramsey Investigates. On tonight's show, I have a very special guest. He comes to us from the UK, Yorkshire in particular. His name is John Hamer. He's an author of four books now. One is The Falsification of History, Our Distorted Reality. The next is two books about the Titanic. One is nonfiction. The other is a novel. The first one is RMS Olympic. Second is Titanic's Last Secret. And he's done two books about the banking industry, a volume one and two titled Behind the Curtain, a chilling expose of the banking industry. But tonight we're going to talk about some true crime. It's about this Soham murder, the murder of two 10-year-old girls in east of London in the UK. And John has written an article titled The Soham Scapegoats, a Gross Miscarriage of Justice. So we're going to talk about probably some pretty sensitive material and stuff. So if you have any children or you're sensitive to these kind of murders, please do not, don't listen or don't have this audio open. So, John, are you there?
I am, William. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for being here. I appreciate it. And you've done some YouTube stuff. You had told me in the pre-show when we were talking that you also talked about your Titanic material, and you have a YouTube presentation that's had over 500,000 views. Is that correct?
That's correct. Yeah. I did a lot of research on the Titanic, and that was sort of the culmination of it, and then followed by the books. Yeah.
Cool. And so how did you, maybe before we can get started, you can talk a little bit about your background and how you got started writing these books, and then how you came across this Soham case.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, well, I spent most of my working life in IT, chained to a corporate desk, various roles within the IT industry, until I was sort of forced into retirement a few years ago through redundancy. And I'd reached the age at that time that it was, difficult to get a job in the IT industry because it's a young world out there, for IT people. So I decided really to sort of take up my hobby as a full-time thing, really, and that my hobby is alternative history. And so I've started off writing a few articles here and there, got them published on various websites, and I thought, I can probably write a book now because I've got enough material and information and experience. So I wrote The Falsification of History, which fortunately for me sold really well and continues to sell really well. And from there, I branched into the Titanic research, did a lot of research on the real Titanic story, wrote a couple of books, as you rightly said, one's nonfiction and the other one is a novel. And my latest book is the massive Behind the Curtain, as you say, volumes one and two, which is like sort of 600,000 words altogether. So that was a massive project. And I'm just about to finish my latest book, which is called JFK, A Very British Coup, spelled COUP. It's a slightly different angle on the JFK assassination story, which I think people may find interesting. But that's probably going to be published in the next month or so.
Great. Well, I look forward to reading that. I'd be happy to interview you about that book when that's completed. How did you get involved in this Soham case? And maybe you can give the listeners, at least the ones in the U.S. who may not have heard of the case, kind of a primer or a background about just the details of the case.
Well, it came to my attention as part of my general sort of research into alternative history, I guess. I think everyone in Britain, I'm maybe not so sure about the States, but I think everyone in Britain was aware of it when it happened because it was headline news for weeks and weeks on end. The papers and the TVs were full of it all the time. And basically, what the story is about, it's about two 10-year-old girls who were sexually assaulted and murdered by certain people, and this is the controversy that we're about to talk about. These two 10-year-old girls lived in a small market town in rural England, and the incident took place in August 2002. And The problem is when the mainstream gets hold of a story, they really go to town with it, as you probably know. And I was absolutely shocked when I read certain, shall we say, criticism for what had actually gone on behind the scenes. And I started to look deeper into it, and I came across all sorts of interesting information that really made me think that actually the official story is not true at all. These two people that were accused, a gentleman by the name of Ian Huntley and his lady friend Maxine Carr, who were arrested and convicted of the murder, I believe, are totally innocent.
Interesting. And the girls went missing the 4th of August. They were seen in Manchester United shirts, red, bright red shirts. And,
yes.
So there was some, like, about 2 weeks before these two suspects were arrested. Can you talk about how that investigation kind of went on?
Yeah. The day that the two girls disappeared, or it could have been the day after, but the small market town of Soham was absolutely inundated with the world's press, basically. These two young girls had gone missing, and there was a massive manhunt going on in all the surrounding countryside. And Ian Huntley and Maxine Carr were immediately put in the forefront of the investigation, not so much because they believed them at that point to be guilty necessarily, but because Maxine was a teaching assistant at the girls' school. I mean, it's only a very small community, don't forget. So more or less everyone knew everyone else, broadly speaking. And Ian was the janitor at at the local college, a very small college, but yeah, he was the janitor there. So they both knew the girls, and they somehow the reporters homed in on them, and they gave a very, shall we say, I would say a very credible account of their movements that day, and the fact that they were helping the police with their inquiries, not in the sense of being suspects, but just, you know,
right,
showing the police around the place, helping them to get around and look at the different locations and all that kind of thing.
Right, so they were interviewed.
They became prominent, before they became suspects.
Right, so they were on video. They were being interviewed by all of these different media outlets, and there's video of them talking about the situation, correct?
Yeah.
Right, okay.
Yeah, that's right.
So what led to their arrest?
Sorry?
Oh, I was just going to say, what led to them moving from, you know, locals being interviewed to being suspects?
Right. Okay. Yeah. The whole premise of my investigation, of my, shall we say, belief in what happened, is something that some people might think is fairly off the wall. But I believe what happened, they were just handily placed at that time, and the police didn't really want to go to the places where they ought to have been going in order to properly invest the crime because of the political situation at that time in the UK. Do you want me to explain that a little bit more?
Yes, definitely. Absolutely.
Right, okay. Well, if the listeners cast their minds back to August 2002, they might recall that it was about 6 months before the invasion of Iraq with US and Britain. British forces invading Iraq. And at that time, obviously the British public and even the American public weren't aware that that was going to happen, but obviously that was in the pipeline politically. And Tony Blair and George Bush had already been colluding about a joint operation to move into Iraq later that year, well, in fact, in the following spring. And the last thing that Blair and his government needed was any kind of public opinion that was going to, shall we say, put American service people stationed in Britain in a very bad light. And it's significant that the village of Soham is about 10 miles from a massive USAF base called USAF Lakenheath, which housed about 10,000 American servicemen. Some of them were stationed there permanently, and some were, it was used as a transit, a stopover, if you like, from troops going back and to from Afghanistan to the States. Obviously, it was a long hop, so they used to stop over at Lakenheath a lot of the time. Sometimes they did that in Germany, but sometimes it was Laken Heath. So there's a massive amount of American servicemen moving in and out of that camp at all times. But the point, sorry, I've gone off the point a little bit there, but the point of it is the fact that Blair could not risk actually investigating as to whether it could have possibly been an American serviceman that had done this dirty deed, because he didn't want to turn public opinion against the US or its servicemen in any way because of what was about, what was in the pipeline and what was about to happen.
They knew
that
it was going to happen. Gotcha. Yeah. And wow. So, all these things were happening. And but the other thing is that what we'll find out later is that the girls were found close to Laken Heath, correct?
They were found in a ditch on the perimeter fence of Laken Heath Air Base, yeah.
Right. So that also kind of implicates these Laken Heath and Mildenhall, these two
yes.
American, and there's also
huge
actually,
bases.
Yeah, there's also Brit. You know, the UK also does have some air bases around there as well. So there's definitely a military presence in that area.
Mm. Huge military presence in that area. Yes.
So the girls were found. Do you remember the exact date when they were found? They went missing the 4th of August. Do you remember when they were found?
No, it was later that month. It was towards the end of August. I think it may have been not perhaps at the end, probably the middle of August. It was a couple of weeks.
Right. So, but were they found after the arrest of Huntley and Carr or before? Do you know?
And they were found after the arrest.
After, gotcha. So they didn't even have, but they also found that when the girls were found, they were in an advanced state of decomposition, correct?
Yes, they were. They'd been dead, obviously, for 2 or 3 weeks. I can't remember the exact time scale. But it was also obvious that they weren't put there immediately after they died. They were probably dumped there at some stage shortly afterwards.
Gotcha.
Because they would have been found a lot sooner if it had been. That was the point. So they must have been hidden away, and I suspect somewhere on the huge air base. There's a lot of unused buildings,
hangars, right?
Yeah, exactly. And there would have been, a myriad of places to hide a couple of small bodies and then to dispose of it when the time was felt to be right. Yeah.
And
absolutely.
The other thing is that would have been, that was kind of a distance from where Huntley was residing. It was something like a 16-mile drive, right?
I think it was 10 miles I had in my head, but you might be right. I can't remember the exact mileage, but yeah, it was a bit of a drive. Not horrendous, but yeah. The other thing was, why on earth would anybody in their right minds drive 10 miles and dump a body somewhere where they were bound to be seen, because there were so many comings and goings of different people? You know, it was such a busy spot. I mean, no one in their right minds would drive from Soham to Laken Heath and dump it at the perimeter fence of a huge air base where there was so much activity going on all the time.
And monitoring, I mean, they monitor the perimeter. So.
Well, exactly. I mean, and what had happened was in the previous few weeks, as the build-up to Iraq, although it was still secret, was going on, They were increasing all the security at all the bases. So they had this state-of-the-art security system put in. And importantly, I think this is very significant, actually, that it's known that the camera positions were changed daily. And also, there were the sweep of the cameras as to where they actually panned around, that was also changed. The angles were changed all the time. So there was a constant changing of so that, even if there might have been blind spots here and there, you had to know exactly where those cameras were pointing and what their arc of sweep was to actually escape them. Now, Huntley wouldn't have had a clue about that, whereas an American serviceman might have. I'm not saying definitely would have, but might have. It's certainly been a better position than Huntley to understand exactly where the cameras lie and where their points of view were.
Gotcha. And so after their arrest, the oddity one, they were taken to the Old Bailey in London, correct?
Or he? Yes, was. They were.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, and that in itself was a strange thing. I mean, the Old Bailey, I don't know whether it's sort of famous in the States or not, but it's the most famous court in the UK, and it's where they take all the big, high-profile cases. But this, okay, yeah, it was a high-profile case, but usually for something of that nature, apart from the fact that this had been blown up into massive proportions by the press, just to get the point across that these people were evil and all the rest of it, I believe that, it could have been done locally. I mean, it should have been done locally. There are high courts all over the country, and it's unusual, shall we say, for something like that to be moved to the Old Bailey.
Right, and then it's like even stranger things, according to your article, happened where Huntley was sectioned. I mean, that's kind of a term, a UK term, but sectioned 3 days after his arrest and sent to a mental institution.
Yeah, he was. Yeah, I mean, they immediately on his arrest, they tried to coerce and cajole him into confessing, which he flatly refused to do. They actually leaked some information to the press, which is totally against,
right. Unethical, illegal.
What's right and what's wrong. Yeah, illegal. That he'd been arrested for rape a few years earlier. Well, that was true, but they didn't qualify it by saying, by the circumstances. He was 16 and his girlfriend was 15, and he was actually arrested for, they had had consensual sex, and he was actually arrested for statutory rape, which is the term for sexual intercourse with an underage girl, even if you're only 16. So, but they never qualified that. So it was splashed all over the newspapers and all over the TV and radio that Huntley was a rapist. Which is prejudicial. You cannot release that kind of information before a trial, because obviously the jury would have been aware of it and all the rest of it. So that's just one small thing that they did. And then they brought in, after about 3 days when he'd not confessed, they brought in a team, not just a team of psychiatrists who allegedly pumped him full of all sorts of stuff, and he was certified insane and carted off to the most brutal, violent hospital for the criminally insane in the UK, and it's got an appalling reputation, and that hospital is called Rampton in Nottinghamshire. Gotcha. And it's apparently it's brutal,
so he just keeps getting moved around. So he's in eastern UK, goes to London, sent off to Nottinghamshire. It's just very odd that he got this treatment.
Yeah. I mean, the whole thing was just, none of it made any sense unless you understand the background motivation, if you get what I'm saying.
Right.
Just to take everything at face value, that was the thing that struck me when I read all this stuff. I thought, none of this sounds right. None of this sounds as though it's, it's the way that things should be done, and it definitely isn't. But a lot of people don't look too deeply, as we know, and these things just get glossed over, and right. People shrug their shoulders and get on with their life. And that's what the people who perpetrate this kind of stuff depend on, unfortunately.
And there was no forensic evidence they could find in his house or indicating in his car that he had transported any bodies, correct?
Absolutely correct. They found no DNA in his home, where they eventually decided that that's where the murders had taken place. They found no DNA in his car after he'd driven 10 or 16 miles or whatever the distance was on bumpy country roads with two bodies in the trunk. They couldn't find anything. I mean, the weakness of the case was highlighted for me by the fact that the prosecution in the trial actually came out with a statement that he said that one of the police officers that had gone to Huntley's home to examine it, one of the forensic guys, he'd smelled a lemony smell from a type of disinfectant indicating that Huntley had recently cleaned the house. Well, I'm sure there must be a queue of ardent criminals queuing up to buy this this magical lemony disinfectant that gets rid of all DNA traces. You know, I'm sure that would be a massive bestseller in the criminal underworld. Right. You know, it just doesn't do that, does it? We know that cleaning does not remove DNA. There are always microscopic spots of DNA in any crime scene, any violent crime scene.
Right, it would have had to have been
violent. And that was the sum total of the prosecution's evidence, in effect, apart from the other lies that they told, you know.
Right, I think you had written that the prosecution stated that no one would have seen him dump the bodies right near a ditch near the Lake and Heath, which, you know, according to you and kind of how these air bases work, there's all kinds of monitoring and video and all this stuff like that.
Yeah. Absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, it's quite a busy road that runs past it as well, you know, so that there would have been traffic. And, you know, I'd really believe for someone to put that body there, I think, it would have been someone who knew much more about that particular location than Huntley could possibly have done.
Now, when the trial started, did Huntley ever make a statement or admission that the girls had died in the house? Had anything that he said implicate? Okay. Because that's...
He never said anything at all that would implicate him in the crime. But again, this is where the lies come in at the trial. The prosecution actually lied. By the way, Huntley didn't appear at his own trial.
That's
which,
amazing.
Believe it or not, yeah, Huntley did not even appear at his own trial. And so this enabled the prosecution to, well, get away with lies. And then the lies that they told were that Huntley and Carr had confessed, and B, that he admitted that the girls had ever been in his home. And those statements were blatantly untrue. But, of course, those statements were plastered all over the media the following day. And people... You know, if a lie, the old saying, isn't it? If a lie is repeated often enough, it becomes the truth.
That's true.
And that is exactly what happened.
Right. Well, I know similar things have happened in the West Memphis 3. They just keep repeating things. They keep saying that convicted for a crime they didn't commit and all this stuff. And it's like, well, the evidence says something else. So the... So then So Huntley ends up... Do you know how long the trial was or what other elements... show that or indicate that he was not involved in this death? Weren't the prosecution alleged that the girl's two shirts were found at his place of work, correct?
Yes, in a bin, a container. He at the college where he worked, there was a huge sort of storage building. It was called a hangar. It wasn't like an airplane hangar. It was just the nickname for the building, if you like. It was called the hangar, and it was just where all the general cleaning and maintenance stuff, like the lawnmowers and all that kind of stuff, a big hut in effect, where all that stuff was stored. And they found the shirts there, but that was quite a while after the event. And in the meantime, what they didn't tell you, certainly not after the shirts had been found, they told you beforehand, was that there'd been scores of volunteers roaming around that hangar looking for, traces of the girls to see if there was anything there. You know, people had just completely, you know, if this was supposed to be or potentially a crime scene, the fact that they just allowed people to just roam all over the place it was crazy. But the significant thing is that obviously that was done and nothing was found. They were only found much, much later. So to me, that says it's obvious they'd obviously been planted. Because surely Huntley wouldn't have been stupid enough to stick them in a bin at the place where he worked. That would just be ridiculous.
Were the girls, when they were found, were they nude? Were they did not have their clothes?
Right. Yeah, they were nude.
Gotcha. Yeah. So that was when they found it. Didn't they say that he tried to burn them or something? Like they were partially burned? Is that right?
Yeah, they did. It was as though they'd sort of tried to burn them but not succeeded. Now, I mean, those shirts...
Even that is suspicious.
Well, exactly. I mean, the shirts, you know, soccer shirts, they just... you know, they're so flimsy, they would just go up in a puff of smoke, basically, if you set fire to them. Maybe not quite as dramatic as that, but you know what I'm saying. I mean, they're not hard to burn, put it that way.
Right. Well, it's even more suspicious that somebody would try to burn it and then do a half job and then save it. Like, it just doesn't, that's also, it looks like evidence planting, you know.
And there was no DNA of Huntley or Carr found on the shirts, and there was no DNA of the girls either found on the shirts, believe it or not.
Right, their own shirts, right?
Yeah, those shirts are so easy to buy. I mean, you know, any sports shop in the UK, you could go in and buy a Manchester United shirt. You could buy them online.
Sure.
I think you could in 2002, but yeah, they're so easy to get hold of. I mean, they could have got those shirts from anywhere and planted them. You know, that wasn't a big deal.
So do you think that the mental illness was not an attempt by Huntley to feign mental illness, or do you think that they wanted to impose mental illness upon him?
Yeah, I think they wanted to impose mental illness on him because they didn't want him to A, appear at his own trial, and B, talk to anyone ever afterwards again. I mean, I think the poor guy was probably subjected to stuff that goes on in Guantanamo and, you know, the Soviet gulags of yesteryear. You know, I think it would have been that kind of scenario, maybe not as extreme as that, to be fair, but there certainly been a lot of sleep deprivation, I guess, and all that kind of good stuff, you know, police get up to, and whoever else was involved, probably MI5, I would imagine too, which is, you know, the British Securities, Internal Security Service. I think they certainly would have pumped him full of drugs. I mean, I bet the poor guy doesn't know whether he's dead or alive at the minute. I mean, I'm sure he's been subjected to some awful stuff.
Well, you know that he tried to commit suicide. June, taking 29 antidepressants. How he had the ability to obtain 29 antidepressants while he's in Milton Keynes Woodhill Prison is another question.
Yes. Well, yes, it is. It's a very good question as well, actually. Yeah.
But his supposed accomplice, Carr, she is out of jail, right?
Yeah, I mean, she was actually acquitted. I mean, I think she wasn't charged. I don't think she was charged with the murder. I think she was given a lesser charge for perverting
implicating the course of justice. I think that she lied for him.
That was the one, which just basically means lying to, I don't know if they have the same phrase in the States, but it just means lying to the police, basically. And she either got off from it. I can't remember whether she was acquitted or whether she was found guilty and just served a very short sentence. But she was out very quickly anyway, and she was given a new identity and similar to the witness protection.
Right, she served 21 months and then tried to sell a book. I don't even know what happened, whether that book came out or anything like that.
Yeah. To be fair, I didn't follow her case up at all. I didn't really sort of follow what happened to her. I was more concerned with Huntley. You could well be right. I've not really researched that aspect of it at all, to be fair, William.
So your theory of the case, not Huntley, that the interest of the government was to cover up any type of murder by somebody from an American airman, and in the interest of continuing down the road towards war with Iraq. Nothing exactly. That would make the Americans look bad, which, you know, we talked in the pre-show about how many incidences of American troops brutalizing the local public there are in the world, really. It's not just, it wouldn't be just in the UK, it would be in Okinawa, all over the place, really. I mean, even in Haiti, people who were established in peace, so-called peacekeeping missions often are implicated in all types of vicious abuse, whether it's in Africa. Mm. Or even Iraq, for that matter. So,
yeah, absolutely. I mean, anywhere where there are foreign, you know, troops stationed, there's going to be that kind of thing. You know, I don't think it's a peculiar issue to the American forces. And, you know, as I said to you as pre-show, you know, British troops have got a pretty bad reputation for it as well. And, you know, I think as you said, it's symptomatic of that kind of, they live in a brutal environment, don't they? That, you know, the whole lives are about brutalization of either the enemy or you know, and so it's hardly unsurprising that they do behave in that way, because they're surrounded constantly by violence and they're encouraged all the time to be violent. And if I may touch on something else as well.
Sure.
At the time, you know, connected, at the time, and probably still going on now, American troops are subjected to all kinds of, you know, vaccinations. And a lot of the time, I have to say, these vaccinations are untested.
Right.
Now, at that time, there was a particular, I don't know the name of it, but it was an anti-malaria drug, which had been given en masse to American troops everywhere. And it was later discovered that it actually encouraged violence, and it also created psychotic episodes.
Wow.
Yeah.
Probably by design, right? They probably were given
possibly.
Yeah. I wouldn't be surprised at all if the American military did that. We know militaries have dosed people. The Nazis gave their troops, you know, amphetamines and all kinds of things, you know.
And there was one particular incident as well, you know, harping back now to what you were just saying about American troops all over the place. Strangely enough, in that same week that the two little girls were killed, four American service wives were killed by their four husbands.
Wow.
At the same time, upon their return to the States, to Fort Bragg in North Carolina, if that means anything to anyone.
Yeah, it does, absolutely.
Yeah, now that was the same week that these little girls were murdered. Now, is that a coincidence or what? You know, it certainly begs the question. You know, five incidents, in effect, of extreme violence like that.
Yeah.
And four, all at the same, you know, army camp, army base, as well as, you know, the incident in England as well. And it just makes you wonder whether, you know, there is any connection there.
Well, those are the stories that come forward, too. You have to imagine that there's the military's real goal in these stories is to cover them up and not talk about them publicly. And they've had, you know, people trying to leak information and leak videos and things like that. But, you know, what you see in the public is disturbing, but it doesn't mean that that's all of the incidences that are occurring.
No, so, absolutely.
Yeah. So, I mean, in Iraq, I know on your vaccine point, I remember that there were stories in the Iraq war maybe it was the malarial drug. I thought there was an anti-anthrax drug they were giving them that ended up making a lot of people sick. And there was actually a movement within the military to refuse these vaccines. Really, they used a religious excuse, but they really just were concerned about their health.
Yes.
So,
yeah. It's interesting. I mean, it could be that I've confused it. I don't think I, but it could be that I've confused it for anthrax. So there could be two separate things going on, which wouldn't surprise me either, you know.
Yeah. No, it's remarkable. So yeah, there's definitely a story. I mean, you can talk about My Lai in Vietnam. You can talk. I mean, the whole Vietnam War was an exercise in incredible brutality against the civilians.
Absolutely.
You know, just So the military bases definitely, and you have people filtering back from Afghanistan. You know,
yes,
where there are abuses and people see things a lot differently.
Yes.
Yeah, it's plausible. Yeah, definitely plausible.
Yeah, definitely.
And so what else? So Huntley is going to be in jail for the rest of his life, correct? I think he's, 47 now?
Yeah, he will be. I mean, he was in his early 30s when it happened, or late 20s. So, yeah, it'll probably be mid to late 40s now, I guess, yeah. He's definitely there for life. They'll never let him out. Let him out. It'd be too dangerous to do it, wouldn't it? They couldn't let him loose on the public, really, could they? I mean, you know, not because of he's a danger to them, but I mean because of what he might say.
Right. Well, one of the other things that's suspicious about the case is how one person controls two people. You know, that's another concern. I mean, if he didn't make it, I mean, he supposedly confessed to getting the children into his house, but I don't know how that confession took place.
Well, yeah, it didn't confess. They said that it confessed, but it didn't.
Right.
Yeah. But as you say, if he had, how would he have managed to control two girls on his own?
Good point.
Even 10-year, even tiny 10-year-old girls, it's not possible to, you know, to actually deal with two at once if you're trying to do them harm, is it? Because one will wriggle away if you're concentrating on the other one. It's just not feasible. I don't think, anyway.
Yeah, it's very odd. I mean, there's just a lot of oddities in those cases. The fact that he's moving around, yeah. that he suddenly goes insane. So you have pictures of him or videos of him talking to the media in a very, you know, sensible way. And then all of a sudden, 2 weeks later, he's crazy. And they're sending him to this Nottingham or whatever.
Yeah, Brampton, yeah.
Brampton, right.
Yeah.
Is there any? Also, I was reading some of these other cases that he was investigated. People, two of the Cambridgeshire officers were investigating suspects in Operation Aura, which was like a child porn.
That's right.
Yeah. So yeah. Even the people investigating these cases were suspicious.
Yeah, and one of them was actually because he was. I think what was happening was he wasn't going along with the official line. And they actually accused him of being a paedophile himself. So he was the guy investigating the paedophiles, but he was actually accused of being a paedophile. But it was just it was a fit up, you know, a frame up, just, you know, for actually stepping out of line, I think. And I didn't follow that through. I can't remember what actually happened to the guy, but I just remember reading that particular thing.
And have you heard of Mark Richard Hobson? Didn't he have an encounter with Huntley? Did you hear that?
No, I didn't.
Yeah,
no.
I guess Hobson tried to kill Huntley in jail. Hobson was a multiple killer or something in Yorkshire. Do you remember? Do you know that story?
No, I don't.
Yeah, I guess there was something about it. Killed four people in North Yorkshire, England in 2004.
Okay, yeah, that sounds familiar. I mean, yeah, but yeah, I don't recall the name, but yeah.
Is there anything else we missed, or any other points you would want to make?
There's one or two things we could pick up on here. For instance, you know, the Huntley's defense. I mean, the guy wasn't there at the trial, but you know, he should still have had a defense. I mean, the defense was totally complicit with the prosecution. They never questioned anything that the prosecution offered. You know, it was a very weak attempt at defence. You know, there were lots of points that the prosecution was making, such as the lies, for example, that a competent defence should have absolutely torn to shreds. But they didn't. You know, they just allowed everything to pass. It was just like a show trial, really. It was like, you know, a Nazi or a Soviet show trial. you know, it was a farce from top to bottom.
There are claims that Huntley was a repeat sexual offender. Do you believe that there's any legitimacy to that?
No, not at all. No, he was indicted for statutory rape when he was 16 years old because he had consensual sex with his 15-year-old girlfriend, and that was blown up out of all proportion. And I guess that might be where that story's emanated from.
Because there, you know, there's been other reports of like other. That he was involved in other abuses or whatever.
No, I don't believe that. I really don't believe that.
Interesting. Okay. I wonder when did Dr. Kelly died a year later. That was involved in the Iraq War too, so that hadn't happened yet.
That's right. Yeah, I mean, he was, for those who are not aware of David Kelly, he was found dead in a field near his home. Allegedly of suicide, but he had been someone who'd been a weapons inspector in Iraq and had come back and written a report that said there were no weapons of mass destruction anywhere in Iraq.
Right.
And so he didn't last too long after that.
Right, and there was a dossier that he contradicted, right? So they called it the dodgy dossier. He said that there's no merit.
Dodgy dossier,
And he's dead. Suspicious circumstances. So that's another, I'm not saying it's associated if Huntley and Carr didn't do it and somebody else did, but there's also this push, even in the States, anyone who was against the war, it's still dangerous to talk about the people who died. who were against the war over Iraq. So it's pretty bad.
Yeah. To go against, somebody once said to me, to go against, you know, any prominent person who goes against the government line, it's a very unusual way to commit suicide.
Right. Well, very true. I mean, even here in the States during Vietnam, once Martin Luther King started speaking out Vietnam, he was dead, you know. So a lot of the, and the people who replaced Martin Luther King weren't as outspoken against Vietnam. So it's very interesting how these public figures can suddenly die. So it's not outside of the realm of possibility that these military guys are involved or involved in real brutality.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, I believe, well, obviously I do, because I mean, that's what I've written about and that's the conclusion I've come to. But I believe it was an American serviceman. I have no idea of names or anything like that. And I don't think we will ever will know. But it is my belief, based on the evidence that I've uncovered and the, you know, just the very substance of the whole incident, if you like, that it was an American serviceman that carried out. And I think it could only have been an American serviceman that carried out. And the fact that, you know, the Iraq war was looming 6 months hence is just sort of the icing on the cake for that, really.
Right.
Because that gives the government a motive to actually create two scapegoats, which is what they did.
Right, take a guy without very many resources who, you know, they can tie. It's very strange, yeah. Supposedly drove, I guess it was 12 miles is the actual distance between his house and the military base. So,
yeah, it is around that sort of figure, yeah. I can't remember
the exact. They did things like that here in the States. The FBI framed a couple guys. They actually sued and won regarding the anthrax documents. If you remember the anthrax cases that happened after 9/11, there was all kinds of super dodgy prosecutions, actually.
Yeah.
And one guy committed suicide, supposedly. Another guy, I think he was a doctor from South Africa. I can't remember his name, but there were all kinds of trying to label on him. And he won a multi-million dollar judgment, if my memory serves me correct. There's
really?
A professor, professor out of, whose name escapes me right now, who covered the real kind of machinations, the Byzantine machinations of these inquiries into the anthrax. And they were definitely trying to, I mean, in my opinion, they were definitely trying to find somebody to blame who wasn't the perpetrator of the anthrax letters. So, and with all kinds of propaganda and all kinds, so these do happen, you know.
I'm sure it goes on all the time, and a lot of the time we won't even realize it. It's just every now and again something happens and a red flag is raised, and you can actually go in and have a look at the evidence and examine it for yourself and come to your own conclusions. But a lot of the time, I guess it's sort of more kept in the closet, if you like, and it's not possible to do that. But I'm sure it still goes on.
All right, John, we are now at the 45-minute mark. And where's that presentation on the Titanic? Do you know what the title of that presentation is?
I can tell you in 1 second.
Okay. Well, is there anything about the Soham case that we didn't cover that you want to finalize?
No, I think
okay, good.
I think that covered it.
Cool. I think that was a good ending, yeah. We're still recording, but so you have a half a million YouTube view thing on the Titanic. And while you're looking at that, maybe where can people find your work?
Okay. If you go to Amazon.com or Amazon.co.uk, and search for John Hamer, search in the book sections for my name, John Hamer, they're all on a page there.
Gotcha. It's Hamer. Just like it sounds.
Yes. The YouTube video, Hamer, yes. The YouTube video is called The Titanic Conspiracy, The Great Deception by John Hamer.
Gotcha. That would be very interesting. And the books, again, The Falsification of History, Our Distorted Reality, RMS Olympic, that is the nonfiction version, Behind the Curtain, A Chilling Exposé of the Banking Industry, Volume 1 and 2, and then a novel, Titanic's Last Secret. And you also do you have a blog or you write articles, is that correct?
Yeah, I have a website, a blog with articles on there, which I update not as often as I would like to, but it does get updated quite a bit. There's about 150 articles on there. And that is falsificationofhistory.co.uk.
Gotcha, cool. All right, John Hamer. Go check out his stuff and I really appreciate you taking the time to discuss this case.
Thank you, William. It's been my pleasure to speak to you.
All right, cool. All right, I just stopped the recording.